This is Jim Highsmith, and you're now listening to the Idol of Ride Easy podcast.
Hello and welcome to the next installation of the Agile Uprising podcast. I'm your host, Ryan Lockard, and with me from the Uprising is Jay Hersko. And we're very lucky today. We have David Bernstein on, author of Beyond Legacy Code. So thanks for coming on today, David.
Thank you so much for having me.
So I have the luxury of meeting David a few times. And the first time was, I believe it was the Scrum Gathering in 2014 or 2015, because your book had just been published. And you gave a talk in Phoenix that I know for a fact it was the very first talk of the very first day. And the reason I remember that is because it was the greatest talk that I've ever seen of a technical nature at any conference. And I'm very happy to have a chance to come full circle and have you on our podcast today.
Thank you. And thank you for having me.
Yeah. So as we get started here, we're very lucky. We had an offer sent in to us from White Shark Consulting. So whiteSharkConsulting.com. Their president, Jason Cusack, offered up to buy a copy of Beyond Legacy Code for one of our listeners. So when this gets published, anybody that retweets the tweet is in a drawing to have a free copy of Beyond Legacy Code sent to them by way of the Agile Uprising and WhiteSharkConsulting.com. So,
oh, how nice!
Yeah. Thanks, White Shark.
Yep. All right. So, David, Beyond Legacy Code. It's a compelling title for anyone that's worked in the software industry. And I guess the first question I want to lead off with is, why that subject?
Oh, interesting. People have told me that the title is sometimes a bit misleading for people because, of course, there's a famous and amazing book that has the words legacy code in it for us developers. It's called Working Effectively with Legacy Code by Michael Feathers. Mm-hmm. My book is very different than Michael's book, but I do want to plug his book because I think if you're working with legacy code, if you're a developer, it's just phenomenal.
And he really, it really is the Bible. The industry. Yeah, it's the Bible.
In many ways.
Yeah, it's compelling. Yeah. I've seen it on almost every single dev shop floor. There's at least one or two copies of that being passed around among the teams. But your book is, and I know I asked the question and I'm speaking over you already, but the one thing about your book that is so amazing is you take a technical topic such as, it's called Beyond Legacy Code, and I'm sure we're going to get into how the title is almost a little misleading, but you take a very technical topic and you synthesize it into such functional language that non-technical people can start to draw a deep appreciation for these technical practices, why they matter, and how they should be installed into teams. So you don't have to be technical, you don't have to be a coder to pick this book up and to draw real value from it. So I'm curious if that was an intentional step or if that was just a happy accident.
No. It was quite intentional. And it was because in my 30-year career as a software developer, I've seen a disconnect between the developers, the people who work in the code, and the people who kind of work around the code, our managers, our stakeholders, who may not be as technical, who may not live the code as much as we do as developers. I wanted them to understand the value of these technical practices in a way that I didn't have to like talk about the technical side of it, something that they could completely understand. And I found that not only is it play well for managers and people who are non-technical, but it also plays really well for us technical people and developers, because even we need to reconnect with the value and importance and reasonings behind some of these technical practices to do it really well.
Right. So I kind of led into the fact that the title's misleading, and I apologize if you disagree, but I imagine you understand why I'm saying the title can be seen as misleading.
Sure, because you'd think that it's a book all about legacy code, and really it's a book about how not to get to legacy code in the first place. The reason that I use the words legacy code is I really want that term to be well understood, not only within our industry, but outside our industry. And people who don't have any association with it because they're not in our industry, I think it's a very good term for them to be familiar with. Hey, if you're, you know, because I think a lot of people who are not technical, they think that when their computer doesn't work, it's their fault. And usually it's our fault.
It's not.
So then I guess a really good stepping off point, how do you define legacy code? So if the intent of the book is to never allow it to happen, let's define what the thing is.
Interesting. That's a great question. And I actually define it in several ways in the book. And of course, Michael Feathers defines legacy code as any code written without tests.
Hmm.
Because he believes that, you know, tests are a good thing, as I do, and that they give us a tremendous amount of confidence in our code when we have a good suite of automated tests running against our code. So what I find is the biggest challenge for us developers is the fear of working with an unknown code base. And when we don't have good tests and we have code that's, you know, poorly encapsulated and poorly named and stuff, we get scared and we lose our confidence to be able to change it without it breaking. So my definition for legacy code is simply code without confidence. Mm. You know, when we discount that psychological factor, but when we're scared to touch something, we will not. And yes. What we want to do is make it so that the barrier to entry, the barrier to refactor our code is small so that we're willing to do that when we have to.
So you're pretty well experienced both as a historically you were a software programmer. And now you're pretty active in the training and the instruction side of the house. What percentage of the code that do you think that the teams are working with today is legacy code or code that we don't feel confident in working with versus well-written code? Because Bob Martin has that whole huge movement right now built about building the craft of software. And he paints, I don't want to say a grim picture, but there's a lot of horrible shit code that's out there. And I'm curious, in like non-scientific swag, what is your percentage? Like, what do you think the breakdown is?
Wow. And I've seen a lot of code. I've trained over 8,000 professional software developers in my career and worked with hundreds of companies, literally about a third of the Fortune 100 companies and many, many others. So I'm one of the few people, I think, that really does have an enormous exposure, mostly in the US, but also abroad in Europe and other places as well. And I would say the vast majority of software that I see is legacy code. And I want to define what I mean by that is people are scared to touch it. People don't want to deal with it, and it's very procedural, even though it's in an object language. Mm-hmm. You know, you see the word class there, but what's in the curly brackets is all procedural code. I'd say that's the norm today.
And I think that descriptor of code without confidence really nails it, right? Because I've lost track of the amount of enterprises I've walked into where it almost becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy, where everybody's afraid to touch this in the event of what if I break it? And they eventually do touch it, and the odds of them breaking it versus the odds of not breaking it, honestly, it's almost 2-1, where there's a problem more than there isn't. And I think you're right. I think it's because they're so nervous to touch it. And I've come across some weird stuff in my life, old IVR apps and BPM systems that I'm pretty sure it's a hamster on a wheel running a processor. And I think that's a great way to summarize it as code without confidence, because if you're not confident in something, in anything you're doing, the odds of you failing get greater and greater and greater. And if you're not confident in opening up this box and monkeying around and touching stuff, you're on the risk of just destroying things, and even inadvertently so.
Yes. But I must say that there's reasons for developers to be scared of working with legacy code. I mean, if you have the experience of you got to make this change and you got some time frame to do it in, and you make that change and 50 bugs sprout up and those 50 bugs produce more bugs, et cetera, you know, it's like, oh my God, what do I do?
Right.
We have those experiences a few times and we just absolutely are terrified to do it. Now, it turns out though that software doesn't have to be that way. And the way we build software doesn't have to be that way. If we pay attention to a few principles and practices, if we pay attention to the nature of change and the nature of software, we can build more changeable code. And the thing that I found in my career that really fascinates me is that to do that doesn't really take any extra time than to write code the traditional way. Hmm. What does take time is to switch our learning, to get over that learning curve. But once we make these practices our habit, then we can benefit from it all the time.
Right.
The very best developers I know. Yeah.
No, go ahead. Please finish it.
There are people who are even more exacting than most developers that I know. These people who are the fastest coders that I know, like, for example, declare all their variables in alphabetic order. And it took me a long time to realize they're not doing that in spite of being faster. They're doing it because that makes them faster. Because they've found practices that work for them.
So the practices that you're alluding to, I mean, throughout your book, you talk about the nine practices, right?
Yes.
And a lot of them really harken back to the extreme programming practices. There's a lot of correlation between them. I'm assuming you have pretty deep experience with extreme programming or XP.
I'm a huge fan of extreme programming. Everything except the name. If you're not familiar with the name, it is a huge turnoff for many, many people, and definitely people in management. Extreme programming, it sounds like you're going to be coding like skiing down a mountain or something.
Right.
You know, let's face it, we developers were poor namers. Kent Beck, one of the most brilliant people I've ever come across, but he's not the greatest namer as well. Sometimes I think he used for his code, but that name anyway. But aside from the name, the practices themselves, I think highly valuable.
Well, I think the one thing about Kent that I would say is like when you talk about coding with confidence and you talk about building safe environments for developers to work in, I think Kent gets the attribution for one of the statements that is encapsulated in the Agile movement is that he wants Agile to make development safe for developers and for the people that use software. And I think that's beautiful. And I think I think that should strike a chord with, obviously I see a smile on your face, but I imagine that strikes a chord with anybody that's passionate about software development, about Agile development, about building things in a responsible and meaningful way so that we're actually delivering value and the software does what it's meant to do.
Yes.
So, one of the things you just mentioned, David, which made me think, was you talked about how a lot of these practices, your nine practices, are not anything that's so far outside what a normal developer should be expected to do. But the hard part is the cultural shift, right? Shifting your brain and your paradigm to operate in a new way. And as it pertains to the group that Ryan and I are part of, right, one of the things we talk about all the time is Agile transformations and how doing what one of our members calls Agile theater is the easy part, right? It's the hard part is shifting the culture and that paradigm and getting people to basically to steal a book title, rewire their wetware and to look at things in a different way. And I can see after some of the uphill battles I think I've been part of is trying to get a company to quote unquote go Agile. I can see where having a development lead try and force these people say, hey, force the developers to say, look, these are good practices. We really want to adopt them. I can imagine some of the conversations you've been in where you're trying to explain how it looks like an uphill battle, but it's really the right decision to make for you.
Yes. Yes. And I'm smiling because I just had this conversation at lunch today with a client and we realized, yes, it's the cultural shift. That's the biggest challenge, but it goes hand in hand. We need the practices. We need to know it's possible that there is a better way to do things. And we need to know it at a very visceral level. You can't just intellectually say, oh, there's a better way to go and figure it out. Cause like we won't. And we've been struggling all our lives to do that. But having worked with 8,000 developers or more, I've come across a few people who are really like transcendental. Like they are 10 times or 100 times even more productive than average developers. And I've tried to learn from them. What is it? How do they think? What are they doing? What are the practices that make them so successful? What I learned is all of those skills are learnable skills. So I've tried to learn those skills and then share them with others. And I've done that also in the book.
So David, I think just to try to point us back to some of the stuff in the book and I'm actually drawing from the notes that I took from your talk in Phoenix. You're a proud resident of Seattle, correct?
Yes.
So I took a note and in here you're drawing a metaphor for how much extra it takes to maintain things when you ignore that maintenance, when you allow things to get a little bit out unruly. So you're talking about the Space Needle, and it now costs more to paint the Space Needle in Seattle than it did to originally construct it. And I think that's a beautiful metaphor. And if you sit there and you think about that, software is no different. When we allow our architecture to scale and to spin out of control, or we're not doing the proper hygiene aspects of the craft of software development, we find ourselves in that same space. So I guess the question I ask for you, the way that you pose the book is that there are foundational principles, foundational practices that you should really have. And from there, you build on top of them. So you don't find yourself in a position where you're repainting the Space Needle. Can you maybe give us a little bit about what you consider to be those foundational aspects of software development?
Sure. And well, like you mentioned, the book talks about 9 practices. And I think these 9 are the ones that I think are the highest value, yet the least understood. Hmm. You know, so many of my colleagues and friends sort of bemoan the fact that Agile has become this management practice because Agile, you know, got started with those guys that you've interviewed who wrote the Agile Manifesto. And as you know, every single one of them is a software developer. They're programmers. Hmm. So Agile was really invented by programmers for programmers. And a lot of people have bemoaned like, oh, well, now it's a certification thing and it's a management thing. I got to say, though, what's the other option? The other option is no one knows about any of it.
Right.
You know, so actually, I'm really happy that Agile has taken, even if it's not the pure form that we originally intended, that it has taken some form and that pretty much throughout the industry, the ideas are known.
Right.
You know, who was it, Alvin Toffler, that said the future is here, is just unevenly distributed or something along those lines? And I think Agile is here, is just unevenly distributed. So the next phase, the next step of Agile, after you've done iterations and done some of the basic stuff that's easy for a lot of teams, is to go into the more challenging but higher value practices, which are really more the technical practices. The one theme that I see overarching across all the practices that I talk about in the book is to create intentional behaviors that are measurable and then as small as possible, and then write tests around it to verify, automate them, to verify it. And when you build that way, you're building very confidently because you're always moving forward, and you don't have a situation where you have a lot of risk. Hmm. If you're building and we want to, you know, the idea is we not only write the code, but we have it fully tested at the end of the iteration so that we could ship it if we wanted to.
Right. Right. So we've talked a couple times now about tests, about unit tests, about automated tests. And we've also talked about the influence of management on these Agile practices. So one area that I've experienced firsthand, some pressure that I would categorize as undue pressure is the need for 100% code coverage and where you apply tests, where unit tests should live, and how those tests should be constructed and maintained. And I guess the book does a really good job of creating a sober view of how unit tests should work. And I'm curious if you could just give us a little bit of your perspective. What is the intent of a unit test from David Bernstein's perspective?
Interesting. And I like the word that you're using, intent, because that's really the thing we want to drive through. So the intent of a unit test, there's actually multiple related intents. When we do test-first development, of course, we're writing the test before we write the code. So initially, the intent is to propose a hypothesis, okay, or to define a specification. We would write a spec before we wrote the code, right? So a test, really, a unit test when you're doing TDD, is a living spec. It's a spec in executable code, which is nice because then as you go further along, the spec never gets out of date. You can run your tests a month later, a year later, and see, oh, everything's still green. That means that the spec is still in sync with the code. Most of the time, written specs in English completely go out of sync.
Right.
Once you fulfill the test by making it pass with code, then its intent becomes very different. It becomes a point of regression. So it allows you to validate and verify that the test always works so that the code always works, right? Mm. So it's proving that the code still works. which is really good. And that, of course, if you write a good test. If you write a bad test, then it's not going to help you very much. And we talk a lot, as you know, in the book about what a good test means. Fundamentally, it's a unique test that is not repeated in anywhere else in the system, and that it's as implementation independent as possible.
Correct.
And that drives us back to what you were saying about intent. So in other words, I want to write a test around the intent, not the way I implement the intent. And the reason that I want to do that is that it allows me to change that implementation later through factoring, and my unit tests are there to help me. It won't break any tests. In fact, I can, you know, refactor, add all these other classes and stuff, and I don't really have to add any more tests because the behavior hasn't changed. I'm just testing the behavior.
Right, and I think that's beautiful the way you're putting that. And I think that leads to the question, the underpinning of my question is, to what atomic level should unit tests be written? Do you test down to the method, right? Do you test down to which degree do you think a well-structured unit test should be should be pointed?
This is such a great question. This is a question that I see so many of us kind of get lost on. And you might think I would be like, whoa, you got to go all the way down. But actually, turns out, when I'm doing TDD, when I'm writing code, I want to write to that intention. So my unit tests are fairly high level. They're based on the kind of task or the story that I'm writing. Even though they're high level, they're small. So the smallest measurable behavior, anything that will create a result, I probably would write a test. So it's not like I'm writing a test for a huge feature. I'm writing it for this little behavior.
Right.
Yes.
Yeah, and I think what that allows for is it steps into one of the other practices that you talk about, which is the abject need for continuous integration, continuous deployment, which I believe you're a strong advocate for both, right?
I am. Right. Although I'm not necessarily a strong advocate for continuous delivery in the sense that we got to deliver multiple times a day. That is a business decision. And it's
you're talking about to production.
To right? production. Yes. Okay. So when we ship to production is based on our maintenance contracts, is based on our business cycles and all that. That's the manager's job. What I want to do is I want to be ready to ship anytime they need to.
Right.
Because when I build software that's always shippable, it means I've reduced my risk from completely unknown to known. See, when I'm building and integrating at the end of a long waterfall cycle, like I had done for the first 15 years of my career, and over the course of a full year, we didn't really see our code interact with the rest of the system until that year, and we integrated. That's when all the bugs showed up, and all the really, you know, the crazy work times, and you know, over time, and all that kind of stuff. I want to ferret those things out as quickly as possible, so. I see people who are doing continuous integration, but you know, it makes it easy to create different branches. So even you know, GitFlow does this where every team is building to their own feature, to their own branch, and that's exactly the same as not doing continuous integration because the code is not integrated yet. It's only when that code comes together that we actually see the worst bugs. So I'm a big believer in writing everything to trunk and using feature flags instead of branches so that at least I can turn my feature off. So it's not part of like what the user will see, but it will still compile with everything else. And so I get that benefit.
So I love everything you just said. And I'm curious, given that you've helped train, I think you keep saying 8,000 software developers, but I believe you've been saying that for years now. Your numbers should have been increasing at an increasing rate. So I'm gonna say that you're probably closing in on 10,000, right? So.
It's probably over 8,000, but it's probably more like 9. I don't know. It's hard to tell.
Yeah, but. When you start talking about these larger enterprise level projects, right, where you have more than 5 teams, more than 10 teams, maybe more than 50 teams working off of one set of shared software project, how much more difficult then does it become for this continuous integration to be a reality, for these meaningful 9 practices to be part of the fabric of those very large dare I use the word scaled teams.
I'm just thinking about this today, in fact. And I think that overall, the larger the project, the more we need these practices, because they're really about scaling and how to scale from a code level, how to scale our code and how to scale up the behavior so that it's, everything's more maintainable. So I see software development as a social activity as much as a technical activity, because we have to communicate in order to work together. And developers, we have our, each of us have our own style and different ways of doing things. And that's cool. That's awesome. What we want to do is find touch points so that when it's time to integrate, we can come together more easily. Right. So I don't want to stifle any of our creativity. I don't want to stifle our ways of doing things. I just want to find the places where we can integrate more easily.
I love how you position software development as a social activity. Obviously one of the pillars of extreme programming is pair programming. And I know you're connected with Woody Zoll, and he's a fan of mob programming, which I know you are as well. It's interesting how important that becomes, especially when you start shifting that culture within the team, the ability for software developers to work together, to communicate in both a verbal and nonverbal fashion. And pair programming, I think, is really one of those connective tissue pieces that helps underscore that. And one thing that I do with my software teams, when we're looking to bring on a new developer, for which I have two open positions, if there's any .NET developers in the Philadelphia area that is looking for a position, at AgilePHL on Twitter, you have to be a rock star. And by the way, here's a little heads up. Part of the interview process, after you get through some of the very basic, do you know what you're talking about, is you sit with one of my developers and you pair program on production level code. We don't sit there and just ask you a bunch of theoretical questions. We want to make sure that you can have that conversation, that you're comfortable keyboard to keyboard, mouse to mouse, shoulder to shoulder with that driver and navigator type of situation. And David, I love the degree to which you push for social communication with on teams. Is there anything beyond pairing and mobbing? How else do you drive for that collaboration and that social aspect?
I think one of the main things is having a ubiquitous language. And this is what a lot of teams really lack. A common set of touch points and a common set of terminology so that we can communicate most effectively. So that's one of the things that I share in the book and also in my classes when I teach is touch points so that we can, again, communicate and get more value. I try to help people think about development at a much higher level than we normally think. So I'm a big proponent, for example, of design patterns. In fact, it's one of my very favorite topics. I didn't talk about it really in the book because I'm planning on writing another book.
An exclusive for the Agile Uprising.
Breaking news. If you guys don't mind, I'd like to unpack that paired programming discussion. Yes. One of the it's a concept that if you're not really digging into it from a software development perspective, right? If you're just an executive over an IT shop that maybe isn't caught up to speed, that's a concept that I sometimes have trouble getting people to grasp, right? I had someone say that, you know, you're only using half your brain when you type at the keyboard, and then somebody made a wise-ass remark where if I type on two keyboards simultaneously, does that mean I'm not using my brain at all? But
Wait a minute. Who made that wise-ass remark, Chad?
This is not a coach that we know, a developer, and I'm pretty sure I actually hired a couple of those guys. But how do I make that argument, right? If you could help me explain to even our listeners how it isn't two developers working at half efficiency, which combined to one, and it really is two developers working at two developers' efficiency, and then some, right? How do I make that argument?
Yeah, well, I like to start off by saying that pair programming is not about taking turns at the computer. It's about taking two minds to bear on the same task. Now, in the physical world, we'd have no problem with this at all. If I asked, you know, if I hired a moving company to move my stuff out of my house into some other place, and when Guy shows up, then I'm pretty like, hey, wait a minute, you guys, I'm going to need help getting my king size mattress down the stairs, and I need more people. So that makes total sense, right? The same thing is true in software. We have intellectual problems that are just as unwieldy as a king size mattress. And it turns out that being able to connect with someone else and talk it through can be incredibly valuable. Also, there's far less interruptions. So I like to, because there's huge resistance. In fact, pairing is is the one practice that I get the most resistance from both developers and managers. From managers, here's what I say. I say basically, when you're doing pairing, you're working a full day, because you won't be very likely to be interrupted. You know, if I'm working on my own, it's okay, I'll just check Twitter for a minute, or, you know, somebody walks up to me and wants to talk about, you know, the Seahawks or whatever. But you will not do that if you have two people who are talking together. You're not going to interrupt them. So there are going to be far less interruptions. And people will actually, especially when acquiring new skills, will sort of work together and sort of moderate each other, which is really, really helpful when you're learning new skills. And, you know, it almost kind of gets to the point where you're trying to do your best. So at the end of a day of pairing, I'm exhausted. I'm completely wiped out. But I'm also really satisfied because I've learned so much. And that's really the benefit for developers, is the learning is so enormously huge. I learn more in an afternoon of pairing than I would in almost any other situation with 6 months. I go to conferences, I blow the conference off, and I pair with friends because I learn more in pairing than sitting at a session, you know?
And I think pairing really drives one of the other principles of extreme programming, which is collective code ownership. You start having a deeper appreciation. Yes. Of what the code is. But I think, David, there's one part of Jay's question that I don't know that I heard a discrete answer for, and it's one that I'm interested in your take on. I don't think you can meaningfully stand in front of that manager, that executive, or that business partner and say that you are getting the throughput of two individuals when you have pairing. There is a nominal decrease of it's funny when you talk about humans as if they're machines and how many lines of codes are they pushing out? Are you writing as many lines of code when you're pairing as you are if two individuals were working? I don't believe you are, but what I do believe is you're creating more quality lines of code, more software that follows the SOLID principles, SOLID being the acronym. And David, actually, I should lead towards your acronym for clean, right? But
yes,
I think there is, you do not get to 100% individual throughputs. What you get is a better collective throughput.
And I don't know what the reference is. I forget what it is. But in my book, I quote one study that said it's not 50% reduction in the lines of code. It's somewhere more close to 15% reduction. Mm. But that's more than made up for by the things that you've said, that the fact that you're writing far less bugs.
Right.
So you're exiting. You know, we look at where do we spend most of our time as developers? We spend most of our time not writing code. And by the way, that's what, as developers, we love to do the most. Mm. Where we waste most of our time is in two areas, I see. One is upfront in reading and interpreting specifications or requirements. And two, and the vast majority of our time is spent in debugging. So we're spending far less time when we do those two things in a pairing environment, because we have another brain, so we get much more certainty as to what the requirements are. And then we're building less buggy code, so we're exiting much faster. This whole idea of throughput and productivity in a field like software development versus, you know, manufacturing is totally different. And we don't make these distinctions. You know, if it's like the I Love Lucy line of, you know, whatever, you have to do something to the pie or whatever. Yeah, you know, productivity you can measure with a stopwatch. Mm. Asking your developers to write more lines of code is probably a really bad idea if it's crappy code.
Absolutely.
Because crappy code cost enormous amounts of time and money. There was a developer on our team. He was considered the superstar. He was the most senior guy, and he would knock out code unbelievably fast. So we considered him the top developer on our team. He had to leave our team. He was moved to another city. We did some analysis on our team, and he wrote so many bugs that when he left, our net throughput went up by 50%. So he wasn't our top performer. He was actually our worst performer, and we never saw it. Yes.
He was your Brent. So the interesting thing is this. Software development is a part of knowledge work as much as any other artistic endeavor. It's not like Van Gogh or Jackson Pollock got paid for the number of brushstrokes per painting, right? So I'm looking through my notes. Yeah, I'm looking through my notes from your talk in 2015, And everything you said harkens back to something I wrote in the margin. And just for Ryan shorthand, writing something in the margin is something that really struck me. And what I have here is something you said: the best way to improve velocity is to improve quality.
Yes. And actually, what I said, and this is the first thing I said when I taught my first class at Yahoo, which they're amazing developers there, is that the only way I know to increase velocity tomorrow is increase the quality today. Hmm. And honestly, the very best teams that I know don't even look at velocity, because again, it's trying to measure productivity. It's trying to measure. And if I can increase your velocity, the amount of stories you can get done up front, even significantly, but you lose all the time on the back end because you're building and accumulating enormous amounts of technical debt, I have not done you a favor. So the things that really impede velocity or throughput are technical debt, ambiguity, legacy code itself, these kinds of things. And if we start reducing those things by paying attention to the quality of the code, and I'm using the term quality, but as you know, in the book, I talk about five very specific things that are very measurable, and I call them the code qualities that we're looking at, like cohesion and coupling and non-redundancy and things like that. If we can make sure our code has those qualities, then we find that it's far easier and more straightforward to work with, and that the asset of the software that we're building is valuable on the long term,
not just the short term. I agree with you wholeheartedly in the sense that using lines of code or a velocity number, as soon as you put that in front of, especially people who come from a traditional development model or delivery model, you know, the waterfall type crowd, they start to focus on that. And it becomes a number, which is a number of measure. It's a metric. And you're right, it's an erroneous metric. Because what if, I think, Ryan, you just dropped the Brent. Is that the Phoenix Project? Is that a reference to the Phoenix Project? Okay. Yeah. If it's bad code, you don't want more of it. And to your point, Ryan, about the 30% reduction, the 15% reduction, I'd rather have less code that, as in my current role, I'm a PM, right? So I'm worried about getting the stuff out of production. I would rather have less good code that I know works, that I can, to your point about, I can feel confident and sleep well at night, than some guy who I know is hammering through work requests and stories and features, and then come to find out that it's, like you said, the guy who you think is a rock star, and then he leaves and you start opening the box and you go, oh my God, what is this thing? What did he build? It's a monster.
There was this software developer I used to work with, and he used to say this thing, and I tried incorporating it into my some of my interview questions, and I've never quite captured it right, so I'm taking a risk and saying it here. But he used to say that his absolute favorite software commit was one where he removed lines of code.
Oh, yes. Yes.
Yeah. Now, if you ever say that to a Tayloristic manager,
I know.
Yeah. My God, your head starts spinning.
You're working your way out of a job.
My friend Llewellyn Falco once told me that he said to his client once, it was a really productive day. I removed 30,000 lines of code, and they freaked out on him. And so now he says, more like I refactored the code and I made it cleaner and stuff like that. But I always look for opportunities to get rid of code.
There's something to what you just said. I'm not sure that it's expressed in the book, but language matters. And to your point about calling extreme programming, and even we've covered this a few times in different shows when we talk about working with leadership, when we talk about Agile. The way that we describe the practices or the behaviors that we're expressing is very important. If I just came in and said, I took out 30,000 lines of code, high five, it will freak somebody out. But if I optimized, 100,000 lines of code down to 70,000 lines of code, and it's of higher quality, then it's received differently. As humans, we send and receive signals in a meaningful way. And not everybody thinks in that technical manner that we sometimes like to speak.
And that's the fundamental challenge. And it's just a communication thing. It's just that we developers use language differently than managers do. Hmm. So, when managers ask us, okay, you want to refactor this code, why? And we say things like, well, it'll be easier to work with in the future. And they say, oh, you're lazy. You know, we have a much broader vocabulary. Managers and financial people, really, they're concerned about cost and profits. So if we say it's going to cost less to refactor this code before we go in and change it to add this feature, that it's probably more cost effective to do it this way, then they understand it more easily.
Right.
And so part of it is a communication thing for sure.
So along those lines, right, we were talking about refactoring code, we're talking about making code easier in the future. You know, that whole concept of technical debt, it really is like an albatross, right? Especially when you're working with truly legacy ancient code. And the analogy I came up with before we started the call was, it's a lot like appendicitis symptoms, right? Where you're waiting till you're doubled over and you can't breathe and you're in horrible pain to seek help. With code that's got a ton of debt and for lack of a better term, ephemera or garbage in it, we usually wait until the system is crashing and it's on fire before we actually say, oh, well, maybe we should fix this. Do you have any suggestions or pointers, or how do I convince higher up the totem pole, higher up the food chain, that we really do need to not only adopt good sanitization as far as code practices, but also we got to pare down this debt. I mean, you know, it's always, we need more, we need now, finish this project, we have another one coming behind it. What has been your experience about the successful tact I could take or Ryan could take to say, you know, to convince someone that we really do need to pay this stuff down and get it out of the way, or it's a lead weight we're dragging around?
Yeah, I'm a very pragmatic person. If there's a quick fix for something, I mean, and it really has to get out, I'm willing to assume some technical debt. I'm also willing to pay it off later. And that's kind of the thing that maybe some people aren't willing to do. But it turns out that it can get in our critical path. So, you know, we talked about Michael Feather's book, and he has all these great techniques for working with legacy code. I have a chapter called Refactor Legacy Code. Half of the chapter is all about how to convince management that you need to refactor. Because when I ask developers, what's the number one reason you don't refactor code? They tell me my manager won't let me. So I wanted to give people some ammo on when it's appropriate. But we got to know, and we do know, that refactoring all code is, first of all, completely impossible and totally impractical. I mean, there's not enough human beings on the face of the earth to refactor the code that is out there that's legacy code. So how do we pick and choose, really, is the key question. And I think it's based upon what's most cost effective. If we need to go back into the code and work with it again, then we should probably think about refactoring it as a first step, learning it, understanding it, make it more straightforward to work with. And then it's more straightforward to add those features. But in terms of, even if it's working and we really depend on it, but it just works, let it continue to work. I think of legacy code more as landmines than time bombs. So, you know, if we got to go into the code, that's when we want to start thinking about, oh, let's transform it first.
So I think it was as part of our Agile Manifesto review project that we're doing, we recently spoke with Ron Jeffries, and he made a very compelling statement. It's one that I wrote down, and I made sure that I tweeted after the fact. He said that I'm not doing it proper justice here, but asking managers for permission to refactor code is the same as asking them to use an if statement. It makes no sense. We should just make it part of our software development practice without having to ask for permission. You don't ask for permission to use that if statement or that where clause or whatever he said. And
yes,
you should not have to ask the same for refactoring. It's the responsible, meaningful thing to do. It's software is not a commodity.
And we are the experts as developers because we live in code and we understand software very, very differently than the rest of the world. And so, you know, people, we have to first of all step up to that role and say, you know, it makes sense to do this right now, or it doesn't make sense to do this right now. I mean, there are lots of times when, you know, if it's just that we want to learn a new technology, then maybe, you know, maybe it's not the best thing for the company. But what I find is developers, by and large, really care. They care about doing the right thing.
Sometimes they care too hard. I mean, drawing from Mary Poppendick. Drawing from Mary Poppendick, she uses a term that I love. It's called rogue development. And when you care too hard and you refactor an entire project because you saw something you didn't like, man, that has some repercussions.
Yes, it does. It does. And it probably could erode trust that management would have in us too. Mm. So again, there's business decisions and there's always trade-offs that we have to make. In fact, we don't live in an ideal world. So the art of software development is really the art of making the right trade-offs.
Right.
That's what we do all day.
Completely agree. So one parable that you're familiar with, Lisa Atkins, I assume.
Yeah,
so Lisa tells a story, she calls it the starfish parable, and I'm going to try to pare it down to the 45-second version, where a little boy is walking on the beach, and the tide brought in a whole bunch of starfish, and he picks up the starfish, and he starts to throw it back, but the starfish as far as the eye can see, and an old man walks up, and he says to the boy, "You're not going to make a difference. You know, there's too many. You're never going to get them all back in the ocean." The little boy doesn't mean to miss a beat. He picks up the next starfish, throws it back, looks at the man, and says, "It mattered to that one." And the reason I bring that up here is we have more software development students, more STEM students in the pipe than we've ever had in the past. There's conservatively 3 job openings for software developers for every one person that has the skills to do the job. A lot of people are probably learning some bad practices because to one of our early conversations, there's more bad code out there than there is good. If you could put yourself in front of a young, impressionable, recent grad or upcoming grad, and you want to give them a little bit of guidance or wisdom as to where they should start to focus or how could they become that ideal software craftsperson of the future that we really want to start seeing emerge to start trumping these poor practices that are in the industry.
Sorry.
That's all right. I should have chosen that one a little differently. anyway, to bring it back, what would you say if you have a niece or a nephew that's about to enter the software development world? How would you steer them so that they start making wise decisions from day one?
Yeah, and I do. I have a nephew who wants to be a software developer, and it's really hard to tell him what the path is to get there because there's really no prescribed path, you know, to be a software developer. I mean, a lot of us didn't even go to school. When I was learning software development, they didn't really have computer science curriculums. Right. So I learned on the job. And I find that even now, when I look at schools' curriculums, that they really don't teach the key skills that we need as developers, right, which are these kind of scalability practices that allow us to build enterprise software. It's very different than the kind of code you write in a semester in school. You don't have to worry about code quality in that short, small little program. But when you're building an enterprise system, you do have to worry about code quality.
When the illities really matter.
Yes. And then also, it is a collaborative effort, like we said. And most computer science curriculums have nothing to do with how do you collaborate with people, how do you work more effectively with people, those kinds of things. But that's the kind of skills that we need on the job.
So is it safe to say, I mean, for me, if when I talk to emerging professionals, I usually say, don't look for the cool, sexy product. Look for the team that's building things well. Learn those patterns and those behaviors from a team that knows what they're doing. And if you don't know what that is, you know, find somebody that does. Because it's nature and nurture. If you're surrounded by a bunch of people writing shit code in a gunslinging fashion, then that's exactly what you're going to become.
Yeah. We're a very young industry. And this is the good news and the bad news. It's a good news because we get to invent, you know, we get to invent essentially the whole industry. It's a challenge though, because it hasn't been invented yet. So we don't really know what's important and what's unimportant. And we're still figuring that stuff out. I think that the last 10 years, especially, has really changed the software industry. And I think a lot of people don't know that. You know, we're very close to the agile industry, the part of the industry that's agile. And I think that there's some really brilliant things that are coming out of this now that's really going to help in the future. And one of the, you know, we talked about test-first development. We talked about refactoring. These things are going to be very common knowledge and things that everyone does soon. You know, and I'm very excited about that. At least that's my ambition and hope.
Go on, Ryan.
It's interesting you say that. I think it was James Grenning that we most recently interviewed, and he said something similar. And it took me, it gave me pause because I'm surprised. Like, I guess it's one of those things where you have an affinity for a certain type of people, and I still struggle with the idea that not everybody is doing test first development and not everybody is embracing refactoring and pair programming.
You asked me what is the percentage in the industry. I've done a lot of like studies of the industry. And so the 2013 State of Agile survey said that about 9% of the software development, and you know, the majority of those people are doing quote unquote agile, 9% are doing these technical practices, test first development, refactoring, continuous integration, these kinds of things. That's you know, 1 in 10. And in my experience, 1 in 10 of those are doing it well.
It's such a smaller percentage is getting smaller and smaller. So Ryan, you just brought a good question up about, you know, if you get in front of an impressionable young developer to be, you know, what kind of advice would you give? And David, you talked about how, you know, learning good practices and whatnot, we're a young industry, right? So there's a lot that is still, there's a lot of unknown unknowns out there. I can't believe I just quoted Donald Rumsfeld. but we, earlier in the conversation, we talked, and you also just talked about how we're coupled, the development practices that you speak of are coupled tightly with a lot of the agile mindset, the agile initiatives. And we talked about very, very early in the conversation about how it sort of seems that the managerial, framework-y, agile, safe, dad, lean, Nexus, whatever, is sort of taking over the space. And in that regard, software code, I mean, there's been less emphasis on code quality. I know Uncle Bob loves to rant about this sort of stuff. So, so how do we get, what are your hints or suggestions to try and get that, not ship turned around, but get the focus a little bit more back onto, well, let's not worry about so much about the framework. Let's worry so much about, at the end of the day, delivering good product, delivering good code. How do we get back to that?
Well, that's why I wrote my book. Because, and that's the real issue that I wanted to talk about was, you know, agile software development does have something to do with software development. So we got to really focus on some of the technical practices as well. And they give us the highest value, which I think is great. And by the way, I just yesterday listened to the James Grenning podcast that you did. It was excellent. And I love James. He's just not only brilliant, but like many of the authors of the original Agile Manifesto, some of the kindest, nicest people I've ever met.
You know, without stepping out of this interview too far, it is amazing how accurate that statement is. I mean, when we started this, who are we? The Agile Uprising. Nobody's heard of any of us. And almost every single one of them have been so accommodating and so willing to work with us and just happy to share the information. So James is obviously I want to agree with you and say, yes, James was probably one of the most, they're all amazing human beings. So
Ron,
oh my God. Lord,
these people are like just unbelievably nice and kind and brilliant.
Yeah.
So it excites me because when you actually climb the ladder and become that brilliant, like they are, and you're nice and a kind person too, it just is, it means like the universe works.
Yeah.
I aspire to that.
And with that, we're coming to the close of the hour, which is a shame because I feel like I could spend the next two talking with you. You mentioned your book, which is, I think, almost the perfect close to the circle of this conversation. And again, I want to remind people, anybody that retweets the Agile Uprising tweet about this episode is going to be in the running for a whiteshartconsulting.com free copy of the book, thanks to Jason Cusack. So if people were interested in buying the book, if they don't believe in Lady Luck, David, it's on Amazon. It's on any of the outlets that you can you can find any other book. It's through, actually worth mentioning, it's through the Pragmatic Bookshelf, which it's Andy Hunt and Dave Thomas's publishing house, and both again, great human beings. We had Andy. I don't know if you saw, Andy Hunt gave us a copy of his handwritten notes from the manifesto event.
Ooh,
yeah, nice, so they're nice. Freely available on theagileuprising.com. How else can people get a hold of you, David?
So, the book, Beyond Legacy Code, 9 Practices to Extend the Life and Value of Your Software, you can get it on Amazon by going to beyondlegacycode.com. You can get the print version, or you can get the print or ebook version from my publisher, Pragmatic Bookshelf. You can get a hold of me through my website, which is called tobeagile.com, and it's like to be or not to be, so tobeagile.com. And that's my consulting company, and I teach developers these practices as well. So that's how to get a hold of me. Twitter, To Be Agile is my Twitter handle. I blog a lot. I have a newsletter at which I write about a lot of this stuff. So if you don't want to fork out the money for the book, you'll find lots and lots of info on my website, on my blog, about all these ideas.
And I can't say enough good things about your content. The content that you make freely available is amazing. The blog is great.
I'm so honored to have a fan. You know, usually I got to, you know, when I'm talking to people, like tell them about the book, but you had read the book already and you already know me. So thank you so much for that.
And you left off LinkedIn because occasionally I think it may be bleed over content from the blog that you repost on LinkedIn, but you sometimes put some content up on LinkedIn. I think that is
every week.
It's pretty compelling stuff. And To Be Agile may be one of my favorite domain names. It's such a good one. All right. So you mentioned a second book upcoming. Is there anything you can give us as far as what the premise of that may be?
You know, I'm actually realizing that I've been working on like five books, and the one and several of them are non-technical, as a matter of fact. So I'm kind of split between, and there are definitely technical books as well. The thing that I think I'm going to be wanting to do next is really, and I'm just a little scared to say this on a podcast with people listening, but I would like to talk a little bit more to the non-software industry about some of these ideas. So there's that in the works, the idea of, you know, writing a book a little bit about what we're learning in the software industry and as it applies to other industries, because I think we've learned enormous amounts. And then the other thing that I'm real interested in is sort of the philosophy behind this and what it means to think more abstractly, like we're doing as software developers. And I think that we think very differently in modern times today than we thought 100 years ago. And so I'm very fascinated by that, how we abstract the world and how that has changed through time. So I'm writing about that as well.
Do you plan to touch on the neuroscience aspects of happiness, of satisfaction, of the gamification of humans, how we set these serotonin-based rewards for ourselves?
Yes.
All right, so I will be buying that book for sure.
But you're going to have to give me a little time to get it together.
Yes,
it's
sir.
A big project.
All right.
And, you know, the other thing, and again, just by way of thanking you guys, because, I mean, I had to lock myself in a room for 2 years to write this book. And so it's such a great feeling when I see that it resonates with people. So thank you so very much for that. I'll be taking that with me as I lock myself in to write the next several books.
Well, it's time well spent. We definitely do appreciate it, David.
Yeah, and on behalf of Brian and myself, David, thank you for taking the time out of your evening to join us. This has been an awesome conversation for me. And to be honest, I should have probably admitted this early, but I've never written a line of code in my life. I've always come from the PMBA managerial side. So paired programming was one of those things when somebody first presented to me, I was like, what are you nuts? We're going to have two people in it. And it has slowly made sense. And some of the marks, I'm hoping that there's someone out there like me who just heard you remark about it and gets that benefit, because I wrote a lot of notes here about how to talk to my managerial staff tomorrow. But this was great for me. I have to thank you personally. It was an awesome learning experience. And I look forward to whatever more content you put out. I really do.
My pleasure. And anytime you want to have me back on, I'm a game.
So nice. We will definitely find you for that. Absolutely.
Beautiful.
Well, thank you so much.
Thanks, Ryan, for all the retweets.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, I'd like to say it's because I like you as a person, but beyond that, there's amazing content that you push out there. So thank you so much.
You're very welcome.
Thank you, David.
Have a great evening.
You as well.